questions about anything? So it looks bleak for the lab tonight, and I guess I know that everyone can't switch around their labs, but I'm kind of encouraging people to actually sign up, if they're in the Monday lab, to actually sign up to take a slot in Wednesday's lab, just because it's pretty much a sure thing that nothing good is going to happen tonight. I will be there, whether you can, regardless, but it might be smart to switch to Wednesday so you have some chance, a better chance, of actually seeing something. And there is probably room if people sign up and plan ahead for everyone in the Wednesday lab section if that actually came to pass. So we've been talking about stars to know. So the online, there's a list of stars that I want you to be able to point at if I give you lines and dots. And I think we might as well start on that on Friday with the simplest ones, the two cases which are not part of a larger collection, Polaris and Algol. So I'll give you some sheet that has dots and lines, and you will point at the star and spell out approximately the name of that star, right? Polaris, pointing at Polaris. Questions? Then we'll go on, of course, to the bigger groups of stars. So I think we covered a fair amount of stuff last time, and potentially confusing stuff. Kind of falling into two big categories, where we talked about the dynamics of the Earth's atmosphere in terms of the Coriolis force, and where we talked about the climate of the Earth based on things like the greenhouse effect. And if we start with the greenhouse effect, kind of the main story is that you don't really care about all of these numbers and details, but if you look at this diagram, you see that on average, the Earth is getting 43 units of energy from the Sun, but it's in fact getting 102 units of energy from the troposphere. We're mostly heated by the atmosphere, not by the Sun. And similarly, if you look at the light from the surface of the Sun, infrared light, everything that has a temperature is emitting light, and certainly the surface of the Earth has a temperature. So it's going to emit 116 units of energy, and only 10 are going to make it out through the atmosphere. The atmosphere is 90% opaque to the light that the Earth is trying to produce. So we have kind of a we're detaining the energy that the Earth is emitting by having it constantly being re-emitted and sent back to the troposphere to the Earth. So this is the kind of heating process. So even though this thing is going on all the time, of course, the ultimate source of all of this energy is the sunlight. If you turn off the sun, the troposphere will continuously lose energy that won't be made up, and so as a result, it's going to get cold. So I think a useful analogy to keep in mind is this kind of picture that we have. So in this analogy, we have a faucet that is constantly dripping water into this glass, and that's representing the sun's energy. So it's coming at a constant rate. There's not much we can do to control the sun, and stuff is leaking out of this glass. So this is a matter of conservation of energy. Whatever the sun's energy is actually absorbed by the Earth has to be re-emitted. Some of this energy is trapped in the Earth's atmosphere. I don't like that word. Detained is a better word. Because if you follow one of these drops, it's going to leave eventually. We have a certain amount of energy that's detained in the Earth's atmosphere. And the amount of energy that's trapped in the Earth's atmosphere, or equivalently, the depth of this water, determines the temperature at the surface of the planet. So long ago, we had a formula for the temperature at the top of the Earth's atmosphere. It's going to be warmer down below, and we can kind of figure out what's going to happen by this sort of analogy. So if we make the detaining, the trapping, more effective by cutting down the size of this hole, you know the result is going to be that the depth of water is going to increase for a while until we get back to an equilibrium sort of situation. If the sun were going to produce more energy for some reason, that would be another thing that would increase the depth of the water. And if you understand how this analogy works, you can answer lots of sorts of questions about how the Earth's atmosphere is going to work. Okay, so there are the hole represents losing energy from the Earth, energy transfer. And we talked about three ways of doing that: conduction, convection, and radiation. And we said that conduction is the least important property astrophysically, but it's the one that you're probably most familiar with. So if you buy insulation for your house, it's based on an R factor. And basically that R factor is a relationship between the temperature difference inside the house and outside the house and the amount of energy you have to run through your furnace, the heat flux. So usually we think about this thing on the other side of the equation because we want some sort of usual temperature difference between the inside and the outside, and we're trying to reduce this heat flux that we have to pay for by running our furnace. But it's kind of the opposite in the case of the sun. We have this heat flux that we're getting from the sun, this 43 units of energy that are constantly being provided. And so the bigger the R factor, the bigger the temperature difference. The bigger the temperature difference under the blanket compared to on top of the blanket. Okay, so we don't literally have conduction as being the primary way of energy transfer. It's kind of a 50-50 mix of convection and radiation. And it's kind of unfortunate, so we don't kind of have one story. If we look at convection, the important factor is what's called the adiabatic lapse rate. That is to say, how much colder does it have to get with altitude before we start one of these natural convection cycles? So you can work out the dynamics of that, and it turns out it depends on the mass of the molecule that's involved, the acceleration of gravity, and this universal constant called Boltzmann constant. And approximately speaking, for the Earth, it's about 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer. So if that emitting layer was 100 meters higher in the Earth's atmosphere, that would mean we'd have another 100 meters at 10 degrees Celsius per kilometer, and it would be 1 degree warmer on the surface of the planet. Another way of looking at it in terms of radiative equilibrium, if we look at what's called the optical depth, so the optical depth is the distance we're talking about divided by how far on average light goes before it's absorbed, then there's this sort of relationship between the temperature of the top of the atmosphere and the temperature of the surface. If we put more carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere, then the mean free path will decrease. It's of course the same distance, so we've increased the optical depth. The result is the surface temperature would have to be warmer. So it kind of doesn't matter whether we're talking about conduction or convection or radiation, it's always the same story. The bigger the temperature difference, the more energy you'll be able to lose from the system, and that's exactly the way this analogy works. Right? The deeper the water, the faster the flow out this little hole. So how these things act, of course, is that carbon dioxide is the main thing that makes the atmosphere opaque, right? So here's the, shown you this lots of times, here's the graph of the emission of light from the Earth, and here's all this lost radiation, radiation that's being absorbed by carbon dioxide, this relatively rare constituent in the Earth's atmosphere. So that in itself kind of begs the question, why is it that this rare constituent in the Earth's atmosphere causes all of these problems? And the answer is that homonuclear diatomic molecules like N2 and O2, they simply don't absorb don't absorb infrared light. Argon doesn't have anything to vibrate against, so it also doesn't absorb infrared light. So it's only the relatively rare triatomics, multiple atomics, that have this greenhouse effect. And in fact, occasionally you'll hear it said that carbon dioxide is not a particularly important molecule compared to other molecules. So if we were going to add 1,000 molecules of carbon dioxide as opposed to 1,000 molecules of some new molecule like methane, it turns out that the methane is probably going to warm the Earth more than the carbon dioxide would, because we already are absorbing a whole lot of carbon dioxide light. And so there isn't a lot lower that this thing can go. Whereas if we introduce a new non-homonuclear diatomic molecule, then we're going to start from the top and we'll start taking down the light that way. You can see there's an absorption from ozone here. That's actually not all that significant, because you remember the ozone isn't anywhere in the troposphere, it's way up there in the stratosphere. So this is heating the stratosphere as opposed to the heating the surface of the Earth, although it does help a little bit. It is a greenhouse gas. And you see these big wide bands that are due to water. Water also isn't hugely significant because it's cold up there, right? So before we get carbon before we get water high in the Earth's atmosphere, it's going to rain out, condense into clouds. So I know carbon dioxide is kind of, well, any non-condensing, non-homonuclear diatomic molecule is great for increasing the greenhouse effect. So it's not something special that's about carbon dioxide. It's something that is special about the homonuclear diatomics and the monoatomics that keep them out of this sort of picture. Any questions? So the whole process, the whole shebang is working because the Earth's atmosphere is at least partially transparent to visible light. So we do get this heating from the sun. If we were to cut off the heating from the sun, then there would be no reason that there would be any temperature difference between the top of the Earth and the bottom of the cloud layer. And clouds are cold. So if we had continuous cloud cover on Earth, we would have the surface of the Earth be the same temperature as the clouds, and that would be cold, probably below freezing. So that's the fear of nuclear winter. If we burn all the cities, we get lots of dust and ash in the air, and we cut off sunlight, and that would be enough to cool the surface of the planet. Questions? So you may know that there is, in some sense, some sort of controversy about the greenhouse effect. So, it might be useful to kind of underline where that controversy exists. So there's no controversy that the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere is increasing. We've been measuring it for 50 years, and I showed you that graph. This is a small piece of it. It's kind of interesting because we can see the plants growing in the northern hemisphere more than they're growing in the southern hemisphere, but there's a steady upward trend. There's no doubt that the carbon dioxide is increasing. There's no doubt that carbon dioxide will lead to warming of the surface of the Earth. So the real controversy is whether that has already been detected. And that's kind of a tough measurement. So if you think about Minnesota, right, we have temperatures that are 30 degrees Celsius in the summer and minus 30 degrees Celsius in the winter. And we're trying to measure this 1 degree Celsius difference. So there's a huge range of variation that we have to kind of average out by looking at lots of different measurements. And there are lots of things that can systematically disturb that measurement. So, there's a heat island effect. If the places that are measuring temperature are near cities that are growing, then just because of the city effect, there's going to be an increase in temperature. So there is controversy about whether the temperature rise has already occurred to some minor degree. But there's no controversy about whether the overall effect is there. And there's also some controversy about correlation versus causation. So if you believe, which, 90% of meteorologists do, if you believe that the temperature of the Earth is on average increasing this pretty small amount, and you believe that the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere is increasing, the correlation between those two events doesn't necessarily imply a causation. So it turns out that at about this same time period, the sun has gone from where it's emitting 0.1% less light to 0.1% extra light, for reasons we'll talk about in a month, a relatively modest change. So there's some people who attribute this perhaps increase in average temperature of the Earth to a change in the conditions in the sun, which could also cause it. Okay, so no doubt that carbon dioxide is increasing. No doubt that carbon dioxide will increase the surface temperature of the sun. Some doubt about whether we have currently measured an increase in temperature, just because it's hard to do. It's subject to all sorts of systematic errors. But, the UN came out with the fact that they're 90% sure that carbon dioxide has already caused a measurable change in the Earth's average temperature. But there's kind of a flip side to that. The usual standard of evidence in science is 95%. So if you want to publish something and say that A causes B, typically you need a 95% evidence of it. So we really don't have that yet for the greenhouse effect. Close, but not quite. Questions? Okay, so then we're talking about dynamics, how things change from kind of day to day to day. And there are a variety of features that you might observe, at least from a spacecraft orbiting at great distance from the Earth. And I wanted to explain how those things work. So why is it that, generally speaking, weather moves from west to east here in the mid-latitudes? Why is it that we have particular rotations around low and high pressure systems? And in a subtler sense, why we can think about the Earth as having kind of zones. So kind of the most important feature in what we're talking about is the Coriolis effect. So the Coriolis effect is an effect that depends on your latitude and the speed that you're going and the spin rate of the planet. And the further you are from the equator, the sign of the latitude, the faster you're going and the faster spin of the planet, the larger the Coriolis effect is. So kind of point one, if you're near the equator, the Coriolis effect is going to be small. And so you're not going to see high and low pressure systems the way you see at mid-latitudes. The weather near the equator is dominated by what's called the intertropical convergence zone, and it's where thunderstorms kind of crop up as opposed to our sort of weather where we have fronts, high and low pressure systems going through. But if we have the Coriolis force, and of course what we're going to have to observe is an equilibrium situation where we have force balance between the Coriolis force and the pressure force. The big word for that is the geostrophic approximation. So in this particular picture, which is from the northern hemisphere, we have a pressure force that is going to be trying to push this air from high to low, and it's going to be moving in the direction of these arrows, because then there's a Coriolis force that's pushing in the opposite direction towards the right that can balance that sort of force. So you can see we get counterclockwise circulation around this low pressure system, clockwise circulation around this high pressure system. And of course, in the southern hemisphere, where the Coriolis force pushes to the left, we have a reversal of those sorts of points of view. I think we've said lots of times that the Coriolis force is mostly present on big scales, so that hurricanes 100% of the time follow this sort of pattern. Tornadoes, not so much. Dust devils, it's really pretty much a 50%, 50-50 sort of operation. And of course, your toilet, totally determined by kind of how the water goes in and out of the toilet. It doesn't flush one direction or the other direction in a particular hemisphere. Okay. So that's kind of the day-to-day change in weather. For the jet stream, which is a long-term process, it's important to think about not just this surface pressure. And again, remember, pressure is the weight of the air overhead. So over this location, there's simply more air than there is at this location. And the pressure force is just the tendency for the lake to average out, for air to try and move from high and low pressure system. But of course, the Coriolis force is getting in. But also remember that we have a vertical structure too. So no matter where we are, if we go up, the pressure is getting less, less, and less. And what's going to be important is how fast does it change? If it changes quickly, then what's going to happen at this location, whereas if it changes slowly at this location, then what that's going to mean is at altitude, there's going to be a pressure difference between those two spots. And we have a relationship between the density of air and the temperature. High temperature air is low density air, and low density air doesn't weigh as much, so the pressure changes less in hot air than in cold air. So here you can see that in this hot air, it takes a great distance before we go down 100 millibars, where in this cold air, we go down 100 millibars in a relatively short distance. So at altitude, we've got low pressure in this cold air, and we've got high pressure in this warm air. So in the biggest possible scale, in Canada, not at the surface particularly, but at altitude, we're going to have low pressure, whereas in the United States, we're going to have high pressure. Naturally, you would think things would move from high to low, but we have to experience force balance. So we have instead a Coriolis force that is, we have winds that are blowing from the west, so that the Coriolis force towards the south can cancel the pressure force to the north. In the southern hemisphere, we have a double reversal, right? The Coriolis force pushes to the left, and the southern part is the cold part, and the northern part is the warm part. And that double reversal also leads to a jet stream that is blowing from west to east. The bigger the temperature difference, the bigger the corresponding jet streams. So in this picture we've seen lots of times. So this is a picture in northern hemisphere summer. And here we have the jet stream at altitude sitting above the polar front, not very strong. And here we have the jet stream sitting above the polar front, strong in the southern hemisphere. And also slight differences between where the troposphere ends, et cetera. Okay, questions about the jet stream? So the jet stream often demarks the difference between the hot air and the cold air, particularly in the winter. So you'll often hear meteorologists talking about the location of the jet stream. And of course, in addition to that, the jet stream is what's driving the weather from west to east in mid-latitudes. Of course, it's going to be different in the intertropical convergence zone where there's no Coriolis effect. So if you looked at pictures of the Earth, it looks more dotted with clouds as opposed to having any systematic pattern. But if you look at long-term averages, we can kind of put together pictures like this, where the blue colors are showing situations where the air is moving vertically upward at these very slow velocities, and the orange parts are showing where air is falling. So again, in any sort of day-to-day situation, you wouldn't notice this, but you can see here that the Earth's atmosphere is broken up into a series of bands where we have hot air rising at the equator, falling at the horse latitudes, rising again at kind of near the polar front, and falling near the poles itself. So we have a series of convection cells, not working vertically, well, working in part vertically, but remember, the atmosphere is a pretty thin layer. It's mostly moving from poles to the equator, right? So convection usually acts to transport hot air to cold regions. And you can see it's doing this in this kind of intermediate fashion. We have one cell that is moving having hot air rise at the equator and fall at the horse latitudes. And it's driving another convection cell here in the mid-latitudes and a third convection cell over the poles. And of course, duplicated in the southern hemisphere. So we do have, subtly, we do have these regions of particular behavior, and we'll see that it's much more dominant in faster spinning, larger planets like the gas giant planets. They have the same sort of zones and belts, but in an obvious degree as opposed to a very subtle degree. Questions? Okay, so I kind of have one last topic about meteorology that I'd like to talk about, and that's ozone. So ozone is kind of a big success story. The overall story, of course, is you remember that in the vertical structure of the Earth's atmosphere, we have these funny reversals of temperature, and the cause of the reverse, this isn't the one I showed you before, but it's just as good. The cause of this heating in the region between the stratosphere and the mesosphere is the existence of ozone in this layer. Ozone is produced naturally from oxygen. Oxygen is usually O2, of course, a homonuclear diatomic molecule. But in the presence of ultraviolet light, we get a very small percentage of that oxygen converted to ozone. So again, I want to stress that if you were going to go here, you wouldn't suffocate from lack of oxygen. It's still going to be 21% oxygen here, but a very small fraction of it has been converted into ozone. What's important about ozone is that it absorbs ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is what causes tanning or burning or, most importantly, skin cancer in people. So if we didn't have this sunblock, R30 or something like that, sunblock for the Earth, we would have ultraviolet light hitting the surface of the planet. And since it would be difficult to put skin tan lotion on all the plants, it would not be healthy for the planet as a whole. So what started to happen, what people started to notice, I guess, in the 80s, is that the ozone layer was getting less and less concentrated. And it's kind of surprising, because you think about the ocean or the atmosphere, it's huge, and even though there are 5 billion people, you wouldn't think that the people could do much to change the atmosphere much. And that certainly seems to be the case. We can't really affect the principal components of the Earth's atmosphere, the argon, the oxygen, the nitrogen, but these minor constituents, human activities have been able to affect. And in this particular case, the problem was refrigerators. So at the turn of the century, refrigerators typically ran on ammonia. So ammonia is cheap, and it's a naturally occurring molecule, and it works as a refrigerant. The problem is that it's also poisonous to people. So occasionally you'd have a leak in your refrigerator, and everyone in the house would die from ammonia poisoning. So people looked hard to find things that were extremely unreactive, that people could breathe in and out and it wouldn't kill them. It might suffocate them if there were huge concentrations of it. So they looked to find the things that were least possible reactive. And what they came up with is chlorofluorocarbons. So we maybe have some fluorines and some chlorines. This might be 2 carbons, 6 carbons. And it turns out that these things are not part of the natural world, but they're extremely non-reactive. They're the opposite of poisonous. And they also work as refrigerants. So they work great inside of refrigerators. Your refrigerator, your car air conditioner could leak, and you would just put more of this in. And this stuff is not at all harmful directly to people. But there is kind of a problem. Because these things are highly non-reactive, they sit around forever. So what's the problem? They don't hurt people. They might build up in the Earth's atmosphere to an extremely minor degree, but of course we have zillions of refrigerators these days, air conditioners, slowly leaking their stuff out, so we can have a very minor buildup of this perfectly harmless stuff. So it still doesn't sound particularly bad. Well, what was happening is the stuff is so extremely non-reactive, it stayed around for long periods of time, and it could eventually work its way up, random walking to these high regions up in the Earth's atmosphere. And while the stuff is inert under surface Earth conditions, just about everything in the universe is broken down by ultraviolet light. So once it got above the ozone layer, it would be broken apart by ultraviolet light. And again, who cares? So maybe something poisonous was being produced at very low concentrations, 50 kilometers up. So it doesn't sound particularly bad. Well, it's not bad for people, but it turns out it's bad for the ozone. And it wouldn't be bad for the ozone if it was kind of like bullets. If one chlorofluorocarbon molecule killed one ozone molecule, it wouldn't be so bad. But it turns out it's catalytic destruction. So one of these chlorines that is released from the breaking apart of this refrigerant turns out to be catalytically able to destroy ozone. So one molecule might destroy 1,000 molecules or 1,000,000 molecules. There's a huge amplification effect. So as a result, because of human activity producing this refrigerant and it working its way slowly up into the Earth's atmosphere, the ozone layer was being negatively affected, not by the material itself, but by this this component that has to do with breaking apart of the refrigerant. So kind of the success story is that, so this was something that was causing problems worldwide, and a treaty was signed in which at least the developing nations decided to not produce these sort of chlorofluorocarbons. They produced things that were slightly more reactive so that they would still be harmless to people, but they would not work their way up to the ozone layer. If they're going to do anything, they would break apart down here where it's less bad. And so what we see as a result of this legislation is that the decline in the ozone layer, the ozone holes, is happening less and less frequently, and looks pretty good that the ozone layer has been saved by switching from the usual sort of chlorofluorocarbons to the new versions, like R22, I think, don't affect the ozone layer, because if they break apart, they break apart at much lower levels. Okay, so this is a case where legislation was able to discontinue the production of something that was harming the atmosphere. And so people hold this out as a hope for solving the greenhouse effect, right? Which the problem is carbon dioxide. And, you know, unfortunately, it's very easy to find a substitute for the chlorofluorocarbons. There isn't much of a substitute for coal. So it's politically much more difficult to get rid of the coal that is being burned to produce the carbon dioxide than it was to get rid of the chlorofluorocarbons. And there's maybe one other thing I want to comment about ozone, because it sometimes is confusing. And that is, so I've described ozone as something that's beneficial, right? It's suntan lotion for the world up here at 50 kilometers. But ozone is a highly reactive gas, even more reactive than the oxygen is, and it's harmful to people, particularly people who have respiratory problems. So if we have ozone at the surface, it's bad. So if you're in a big city, occasionally you hear about ozone alerts, where there's a high concentration of ozone, not down here, not up here where it's good, but down at the surface where it's harmful to people. And if it's down at the surface, it's not doing a good protection job anyway. So ozone down here is bad. It's bad for people. It's bad for plants. And it's typically a product of human pollution. Up here, it's good. And even if we increased it down here, it wouldn't solve our problem up there. So ozone is good where it is. It's bad if it's at the surface of the Earth. Questions?
Is there any way for us to increase that ozone layer?
So we're in the process of not destroying it, which is a way of increasing it, right? But you're saying increasing it beyond the natural level?
Yeah. Or do we not want to do that?
Well, people don't like to mess with Mother Nature, right? So there's a tendency not. So you're saying that maybe we could arrange things so that we wouldn't have to put suntan lotion on at all, and we wouldn't have skin cancer at all. So people are worried about destroying it. I haven't really read anyone who's in the business of trying to increase it. The ozone hole.
Like, why is it concentrated in the south?
So that's a very complicated question. So first of all, what's being remembered here, I talked about the ozone hole, and it turns out that this ozone depletion was mostly noticed in the southern hemisphere, where we would get huge depletions, 50% depletions in the ozone layer down there. And it turns out the basic reason for the phenomena, why it is first notice and is worst at the North Pole is because it turns out it's cold and it's coming out of Arctic winter, and so it's not light. And it turns out that those things and the third factor that's important is the air up there turns out it's not being transported very far. It's pretty much in a box. So all those things act together to make this chlorofluorocarbon particularly effective there. And so that's why the ozone depletion was noticed in huge extent at in the Antarctic. There have been ozone holes kind of recently seen in the Arctic. And generally speaking, there's a decline in the ozone every place. So it's not that the ozone depletion only occurs down here. And in fact, in some sense, who cares if it occurs down here? There's nobody really living down here. The bigger concern is the gradual decline that's every place. But the ozone hole is huge and easily measured in the Antarctic. Yeah, oh yeah, so it's naturally created by the ultraviolet light. So all we have to do is stop destroying the ozone and it'll build back up to its same level. So it is currently going up. So we have measured so it looks like everything is working pretty well. There are problems that people are worried about with the ozone solution in that the treaties don't involve the undeveloped countries, so some of the undeveloped countries are continuing to use these bad chlorofluorocarbons. So for a while, if you didn't want to pay the big price to have your car air conditioner converted in this country that used the modern refrigerants, you could go to Mexico and have your car converted down there with the bad chlorofluorocarbons for, you know, a fraction of the cost. And people were doing that. And I think Mexico maybe has signed on now to the treaties. But I'm reasonably sure that the ozone problem is under control, if not exactly solved.
So then it has nothing to do with how much carbon we're producing?
No, it has absolutely nothing to do with carbon dioxide.
So then why is everybody always complaining about that and how we need to have less emissions?
So carbon dioxide is the greenhouse effect. So the concern with the greenhouse effect is increasing the surface temperature of the planet. And the increases in the surface temperature of the planet are not huge. They're kind of equivalent to moving a few hundred miles south from where you are. So the big concern isn't so much the fact that you'd have to turn on your air conditioner earlier in the year or something like that. The concern is that if the temperature increases a little bit, then we'll get melting of the ice, and that'll raise the ocean levels, and it's bad for the people in Florida. And so if nothing is done, a good fraction of Florida, 20% of it, will be underwater. Not in your lifetimes, but maybe in your kids' lifetimes.
Creating Atlantis.
Well, it's not going to be very deep water, right? So it's just going to increase the swamps of Florida. And so, I mean, the future would be that dikes will be made and things like that. But, you know, we've all seen New Orleans, right? Dikes get overcome. It's not a good time to be buying oceanfront property. Unless there's a big cliff, right? West Coast is better than the East Coast generally. And Florida is among the Florida and parts of Texas, which are swampy at sea level. And there are whole nations the oceanic nations that would be underwater under these circumstances. And those countries are probably doomed because their carbon dioxide level is hard to see how it's going to be stopped on a dime. In fact, you might say it's hard to see how it's going to be stopped, period. So there is, so I was saying that people aren't, so I haven't heard about people being interested in fooling with Mother Nature about the ozone layer, but there are people who are thinking about alternative ways of keeping the planet cool without changing the amount of carbon dioxide. And of course, the way to do that is to change the temperature from our formula, right? If we make the top of the atmosphere cooler, we can still have the extra few degrees that we have because the layer is now thicker. And if you remember the factors that are in that formula, the kind of most important, we can't change the temperature of the sun or our distance from the sun, but the one thing we can change is the albedo, the shininess of the planet. So there are people who have talked about making artificial clouds as a way of reducing the temperature of the planet to make up for the increase in the temperature of the planet, which is going to happen because of the higher concentration of carbon dioxide.
But if we increase the cloud cover, will that not decrease the light coming in and decrease the ability of plants to photosynthesize and get rid of some of the extra?
So any argument based on geoengineering is fraught with problems, right? So, I mean, the first thing that I would certainly think about is all these attempts to control bugs by bringing in other bugs, right? Very frequently, this leads to unforeseen problems. So that's the obvious argument. The particular case of plants, I'm not sure I would worry a whole lot about that because the plants really like carbon dioxide. And there's kind of good evidence that the plants have already are doing better in the noticeably increased carbon dioxide that we have on the planet. So they could probably do with a little bit less sunlight. More questions? So geoengineering is the name for that process where you do start to try and fool with Mother Nature on a global scale to make up for this global emission of carbon dioxide. And there are more than a handful of people, but certainly less than a majority of people who think that that's the right way to go. So the plan is to do our meteorology, our geology, and all that sort of good stuff. I'll take this opportunity. I mean, so it always takes time to show these sort of simulations. So let me take this moment to show some of these geological. Oops. Simulations that I hope make clear the sorts of things we want to talk about in terms of the geology. It might be useful to kind of review the sorts of things we've been talking about for meteorology where we have these nice pictures too. So here's kind of a picture of the Earth, and again we can see these high and low pressure systems at the southern latitudes with their spin, but this whole idea of the zones and belts that I was talking about before, it's not at all obvious in the overall pictures that we have like this of the Earth. This is incidentally the intertropical convergence zone, which is kind of present in terms of these puffy sorts of clouds. Okay, so there are a handful of cases in the history of science where there's been kind of a revolution in how people thought about how that system works. So we've seen it in the Copernican Revolution, for example, where we went from the idea that The planet, since it was a heavy object, was stationary to the idea that the planet was moving around. And there's a similar sort of huge change in our understanding of geology that, I don't know, dates to the 50s or the 60s. So the original idea goes back to more like the 1920s, but it simply wasn't accepted at all at the time. It was thought of as a crazy idea. And that's the idea that the continents are moving. So, I mean, obviously, just like the idea that the Earth moves seems like kind of a crazy idea, nothing seems as solid as the places that we're walking on. And the idea that they are moving around on the surface of the Earth seems kind of crazy. But as we'll see, it's in fact the case. So these plates are all moving at about the same rate that your fingernails grow, so it's not particularly noticeable. But in fact, they're moving around. So the surface of the Earth is broken up into these plates, you know, more than a dozen plates, and the location of North America is gradually shifting. And there's simply no doubt about this. Using GPS sorts of satellites, we can measure the distance, say, between, you know, some spot in North America and some spot in Europe, and we can measure the gradual change of centimeters per year. Well, there's no doubt that this overall picture is in fact the case. So how is it, why is it, that these plates are in motion? And the answer is convection. So just as parts of our atmosphere are rising and falling, going through the cells in order transferring heat from the hot surface of the planet to the cooler atmosphere, same sort of thing is happening in the rock under our feet. So it's hotter inside the Earth than it is on the outside of the Earth, and we have the rock actually convecting, just like the water in a boiling pan of water on your tabletop. So we have kind of pictures of how this works. And one of the things that made this difficult to figure out is typically the growth and subtraction of these continental plates. Of course, both have to occur if they're going to move around, because they don't just move rigidly. It usually happens under the ocean. So they don't have water here, but the idea is what we're seeing here is actually happening under the water, and we have magma, liquid rock, that's coming up, and it's pushing the two plates apart. And so the distance between two continents on either side of this ocean is going to be gradually increasing because of this sort of process that is constantly occurring. Okay, so new crust is being formed in these mid-ocean ridges. There are a handful of spots like Iceland where this process is on the surface, so we can actually see it. But basically, this is happening deep underground. So if there is creation of crust at these mid-ocean ridges, then there has to be destruction of crust someplace else. And these are called subduction zones. And here you can see how one plate is moving over another plate. And typically what happens is part of this plate will then, I shouldn't point at the picture, you can't see. Part of this plate, when it gets down, will melt and will come up and form volcanoes on the edge of this moving plate. So we have volcanoes in the West Coast where we have this sort of process occurring. Now there are places like Hawaii that are in the middle of a plate and are big volcanoes, and something a little bit different is going on there. So first of all, Hawaii is part of an island chain, and that chain of islands we can date, and they kind of go linearly from one date to another. And what's happening here is we think there's a hot spot underneath the moving crust that builds up these volcanoes, and then over time they erode. And so we get an island chain, like Hawaii, all pointing in one direction, that is caused by a stationary hot spot underneath the moving crust. What is that? So we can kind of specify three different types of plate boundaries. So we can have divergent boundaries like this, where we have, typically under the ocean, where we have new crust being created, pushing the continents apart. And we can have convergent cases, where we have subduction, where one plate is moving over another plate. We have then volcanoes being built up out of remelted material. And mostly what we have on the West Coast is actually transform faults, where one piece of the crust is moving sideways compared to the other piece of crust. Okay, so this is our introduction to geology. There's one other thing I want to show. I probably should have shown it earlier. Oops, this won't work. Yeah. Oh, it did work. Oh, okay. Well, more or less worked. So here's this picture that I was trying to draw before of these kind of zones and belts that we have in the Earth's atmosphere. Here we have the intertropical convergence zone, where we have hot air that's rising. And here at the horse latitudes, we have this air that's falling. Air that's falling is going to be very dry air at the top because it's cold. So as it falls, we're not going to get clouds, right? We're just going to get more evaporation as it goes down. And the opposite is going to be the case at this intertropical convergence zone. So we're going to take moist air and raise it up. It's going to get cold and make clouds and rain. So this is why we have the intertropical convergence zone being specified by having all of these thunderstorms at this latitudes. And here we're going to have mostly clear air and you might call them nice conditions in the horse latitudes. And this cell here is going to involve, it's going to drive one final cell. So here we have air that is rising at the polar front and it's going to fall at the lower front. And the earlier question about the special characteristics of this polar cell, particularly in Antarctica, that led to the ozone hole, it has to do with this circulation that you see that is basically isolated from the rest of the planetary circulation. Okay. So we live on pieces of rock that are gradually shifting around. So that the stuff that was, so there are, for example, dinosaur fossils that you can find in Antarctica where it's clearly too cold to have dinosaurs there currently. So here's kind of the overall picture. So here we have the crust. Here we have this mid-ocean ridge, which is going to be pushed apart because we have new material that is liquid rock that is rising and solidifying in this region. And we have the subduction zone, where we have kind of the reverse process, as one piece of crust is shoved under another piece of crust. Okay. So we divided the Earth's atmosphere up based on temperature changes with altitude. In the troposphere, it got colder with altitude. In the stratosphere, it got warmer with altitude. Thermosphere, it got the mesosphere, it got colder again with altitude. In the thermosphere, it got hotter again with altitude. So how are we going to divide up the interior of the Earth? We're going to do it based on composition. So the Earth's atmosphere is pretty much from top to bottom, 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, 1% argon. That's not the case of the Earth. So for the Earth, the heavy stuff, the dense stuff, has gone towards the center. And you know, you might ask why that isn't the case for the Earth's atmosphere. Why doesn't the heavier stuff, you know, for example, like carbon dioxide, obviously it weighs more than oxygen, O2, why isn't that concentrated on the bottom? And there are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, there's enough stirring in the Earth's atmosphere that it keeps things in equilibrium. But furthermore, the differences in density between carbon dioxide and oxygen aren't enough to drive actual composition differences. And that has to do with the scale height. Right? So you might remember that the scale height, that's the distance over which you get noticeable pressure changes, that was KT divided by mg. So the mass differences aren't enough to get noticeable differences. So here we've got a core that is almost pure iron and nickel, and we have kind of two versions of it. The inner core is solid, and the outer core is liquid. And we mean really liquidy, you know, kind of as liquid as water, as unviscous as water. On top of that, we have iron-rich rocks, so but not iron, but rocks that are rich in iron, so-called mafic rocks. I guess it's EIC. The FE stands for iron. I usually don't care about getting my spelling right. And maybe I won't again. I would like to get it right once. There isn't any A in it. But the F still is supposed to remind you of iron. So these are rocks that are rich in iron as opposed to the felsic rocks that are rich in calcium and things that are in feldspar. So and another word for this are basic rocks. The basic is referring to the acid-base relationship. So on top of that, we've got the crustal rocks, which are these lower density felsic rocks. So these are similar to rocks that you would find sitting on the surface. They're made up out of lots of silicon. And here we have lots of iron and, generally speaking, metals. And the difference in density leads to exactly the same phenomena that you would think about in terms of, say, icebergs. So we really can think of these rocks as floating on this lower partially melted layer. So if we have relatively low density material, like an iceberg, there's going to be some of it that's up high and there's going to be some of it that's down low. So if we have mountains, we have so-called mountain roots that are floating below the general layer of the crust. The continents, which are of course standing high compared to the ocean, also have to be deeper, go down deeper than the corresponding oceanic crust. So we have this sort of picture where we've got a relatively thick continent, which is high because it's floating high, because it's made out of lower density material, floating on top of this not really liquid, it's more like plastic sort of material that is the top layer of the mantle. Yeah, so here are kind of some barely visible sorts of pictures that are showing the same sorts of things. And again, what I want to emphasize again is the continents are standing high because they are thicker. They're made out of lower density material than the oceanic crust is or the mantle itself. And they're literally just floating high on this semi-liquid plasticky sort of material that is the asthenosphere. Yeah, boy, I hate these pictures. But here's a kind of another picture of the thickness of the crust compared to the of the continental crust compared to the thickness of the oceanic crust. So the discontinuity between the relatively low density continental crust and the higher density mafic material is called the MOHO. And you can see that it's pretty far down, on the order of 100 kilometers, 70 kilometers in terms of a continent, on the order of 10 kilometers or so if we're talking about the much thinner oceanic crust. Okay, so we divide up the Earth into various layers based on chemical composition. Iron, mafic, felsic sorts of rock. And so what we've got are crust and mantle and the outer core, which is liquid, and the inner core, which is solid. And I guess I say we're making this distinction based on composition, but the inner and outer core probably have the same composition. So there we're making this distinction based on the state of the material. Confusingly, there's another system in which we're going to break things up not based on the chemical composition, but based on the rigidity of the material. So the top part of the mantle and all of the crust is solid in the sense that it's not going to flow, and this is called the lithosphere. A little bit down below the top of the mantle, we've got the asthenosphere, and that's the liquid part that all of these things are floating on. Here we go. Okay, so the solid part, the part that is acting more or less rigidly, is all of the crust and some of the mantle. And below that we have this partially liquid phase, plastic phase is a better word, of the asthenosphere. And it's the asthenosphere that's in convection, and it's carrying the lithosphere around kind of like scum on the surface of a liquid. So it's the convection of the asthenosphere that's causing the motion of the plates. So for the atmosphere, we can send things up and we can measure the properties. How do we get these sort of pictures? So you might think it's by drilling, but drilling just goes down tens of kilometers. No drill has gone through the MOHO, the discontinuity between the crust and the mantle. So we're not learning this by any sorts of direct measurements. We have to have some way of seeing inside the Earth. And we obviously can't use light because the light is opaque to the Earth, so we need some other wave that can penetrate through solid material and let us see, as it were, what's inside. And the way we're able to make these distinctions is based on sound. So sound is a perfectly good wave, and the Earth is transparent to that wave, so we can use sound to see inside the Earth. And I use the word sound somewhat generically because we've talked about sound in the air in this room based on pressure waves, regions of compression and rarefaction. And we can have exactly the same sort of situation happening in a solid. So here we have compressed rock, here we have expanded rock, compressed rock. So these sorts of waves are able to propagate just fine through solids. So these are usually called P waves for pressure. There's another possibility for rock that isn't present in air, And that is, for air, if I take two layers and I move them sideways, there's nothing that pushes them back together. But there is for rock. And so if we push one layer up and another layer down, we have something that's trying to bring them back into equilibrium. So this is called shear, and we have shear waves, S waves, also as a possibility for propagating through rock. So by using these waves, we can figure out lots of properties inside the Earth. Now, we don't have spectral properties, so we don't have, sound wave doesn't tell us that this is made out of iron. Instead, the information we can get out of this is the density and the wave speed. So here we can see that there's a big discontinuity in density as we go through this particular layer, the separation between the mantle and the outer fluid core. The other thing that's present is that notice that the S waves disappear in this layer. That's the proof that this layer is a liquid, right? Because liquids can't propagate shear waves. So when we see a region in which we can't have shear waves, we know that that's a liquid layer. And here, when we're back into the very innermost region of the Earth, we again have shear waves present in the inner parts of the Earth. And this discontinuity in density and the P wave velocity is indicative of a different state, right? We've gone from liquid to a more compressed solid state in the very inner parts of the core. Okay, so it's sound waves that allow us to make these distinctions between the various layers in the inside the Earth. It might be worth commenting that it turns out that for most any sort of material, if you put it under higher and higher pressure, you're more and more likely to have it be in a solid state. On the other hand, if you subject anything to higher and higher temperatures, it's more likely to be in a liquid state. So if you think about what's happening in the center of the Earth, we have both of those opposing tendencies happening as we get closer and closer to the center of the Earth. It's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. It's hotter inside the Earth than it is at the surface of the Sun. And it's getting higher and higher pressure. So exactly who wins, whether we remain a liquid because it's high temperatures inside the Earth, or whether we go from liquid to solid because it's high pressures, it turns out it's a very close balance. And our best guess is that for Venus, the balance goes the other way. So Venus is just slightly different from the Earth. Best guess is that it doesn't have a solid inner core. Best guess for Mercury is that it also has a solid inner core. So the existence of this solid inner core is actually a very close balance between the tendencies of pressure to make things into solids and the tendency of high temperature in order to make things into liquids. So it's not at all obvious that there is, it wasn't obvious to the people who originally were doing the calculations of these material properties, that conditions were conducive to having a solid core. Okay, so we'll come back next time, talk more about geology, and more about particular geology like rock types.